Angie has made it easier than ever to hire high-quality pros to get all your home service jobs done well. Just bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie will connect you with local pros who match your specific needs. Or book a service instantly at an upfront price. So join the millions of homeowners who use Angie to care for their homes and get your next home service job done well. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's ANGI.com.
Hello, welcome to the official Hacks podcast from HBO Max and Pineapple Street Studios. I'm Jen Statsky.
I'm Paul W. Downs.
I'm Lucia Agnello.
This week, we're talking about the sixth episode of our second season with a self-proclaimed superfan of the show, the one, the only, Rosie O'Donnell.
Hello.
Hi, Rosie.
Hi, Rosie.
Hi, everybody.
Okay, so let's get into episode 206. It's called The Click, and it was written by the incredibly talented Aisha Muharrar and Joe Mandy. And it was directed by yours truly, me, Paul W. Downs. So, Rosie, it meant so much to me when you reached out about the show, having even seen it, much less connected with it and enjoyed it. And it was really thrilling, honestly, to get a DM from the Rosie O'Donnell.
I remember when Paul texted us being like, holy shit, Rosie O'Donnell DM'd me. She likes the show. It was such like an exciting moment.
And so it's so exciting to officially meet you and not just DM with you and talk to you for the first time about it for real today.
Listen, I think this is the greatest show on TV right now. I just think you've hit it on the sweet spot, and it's so real. And I don't know if it's because being a comedian and being a woman of that age and seeing yourself in your third act is a jarring reality. You know, this year, myself and my two best friends, we were friends since we're three. We all turned 60, and they all said it had a tremendous effect on how they look at the world. And I think it's really true that you get to a point where you don't care anymore. You don't care what people think about you. You don't care what... And some people said to me, well, you never cared. No, I cared a little bit. Trust me. I cared a little bit, but now I don't really care. You know what character trait I love about Deborah Vance? Is how cheap she is. Yeah. Like trying to talk the guy down when she knew how much money she was going to make on that dresser.
Yeah.
And then putting the dresser where it was. What a great freaking idea that is. Whoever was in the writer's room and said that should get a bonus, because that was really fantastic, I thought.
Excuse me. Is this yours?
Yeah.
Yes. What are you asking for?
I can do 250.
Huh. 250. They don't know what they've got. This is worth 20 grand. There's kind of a sizable nick on this side and some scratches here. I kind of have to refinish the whole thing. Would you take 150? Come on. Please?
Yeah, okay.
Thank you.
Sure.
Early on when we were developing the character of Deborah, something the three of us find very funny is rich people who are cheap. It's such a funny like juxtaposition. And so, yeah, you see it even in the pilot, Deborah, we used to have in that, I don't know if you remember in the pilot, in the first scene where she's having lunch with Marty, the casino owner, we used to have her take her steak and wrap it up in tinfoil and put it in her purse. And we didn't end up doing that. But we just think it's so funny when someone has all the money in the world, but part of the way they got that money is that they are cheap as hell.
Yeah.
Especially self-made rich people, you know, people who came
from
being poor. Yeah.
And it's just such a little detail that says so much about the character without having to use it as exposition, right? You just, this is a character trait, and it's just, you know, braided into the tapestry that you guys make every week with this show. So did I tell you what I did to the adorable Hannah?
No.
I'm watching the first episode and I'm like blown away, and I find her on Twitter and I'm like, listen, you are so good in this fucking show. And this is as good as showbiz gets. This is like showbiz on steroids. Don't ever forget, I know you're young. What's happening to you now? It's weird out there. Just hold on to your roots. come to find out she's Lorraine Newman's daughter. Yeah. She doesn't need the showbiz talk from me. What the fuck gonna say, am I doing?
You became a mentor to her. You Deborah'd her, and that's great.
I totally did.
Yeah, so we didn't know either that Hannah was the daughter of the incredible Lorraine Newman, who is a comedian herself and was a member of the original SNL cast. Hannah came in for a pre-read for our casting directors, who had also never met her before, and was completely anonymous to all of us, but really caught our attention because she was so distinct, so unique, and just so different. You know, she loved comedy and loved stand-up and did stand-up, but she's so outside of showbiz, it seems. You know, it seems like she was really sheltered from
that. That's why when I watched it, I thought she was a kid from Iowa that you found or something, you know?
Well, so did we, you know. We saw her in a pre-read and we didn't know who she was. And we were like, she was just natural and just had a different sense of timing. It was as if she was from another time.
Well, that's the thing, is her timing is a little different than I think a lot of millennials. She kind of talks a little slower. She has a unique cadence that I don't hear California at all, personally.
No, I don't hear California either.
We almost, when we finally were doing screen tests and we were like, well, now we have to do a deep dive and background check these people because, you know, you don't want, you want to make sure you have people that are nice. And so then we did sort of this deep dive and found out that she was Lorraine Newman's daughter. And we were almost like, you know, I hope this doesn't make it seem like that had any impact, because we had no idea. You know, that wasn't anything that we were aware of.
Which I'm sure they both love that part of the story, because she earned it on her own, you know, obviously without any of that. But I'm sure that's something that people say to her all the time, right? Oh, because your mom's Lorraine Newman.
Yeah.
Well, she's such a natural. She's such a natural. Yeah. And that the scenes at the fair were for her, like with her giddiness of getting to go on the ride. And I mean, as an actor, you look at that and you go, that's a hard thing to play, right? Mm-hmm. But she does it with such enthusiasm and commitment. And it plays every single time. The choices that she makes are not classically traditional, and it makes her so real and so intoxicatingly entertaining.
And we can't take any credit for that, but we try.
Now, are you only doing 6, or are there more to come?
There are 8. There are 8.
Okay, there are 8 episodes.
Yeah.
So on this, the 6th one, you know, Deborah's got her groove back, and she's ready to go to the networks. It seems as though she did understand the click. She did understand what it takes to take yourself into now, and especially when the before was so big and disorienting and intoxicating. When Deborah Vance was Deborah Vance and couldn't go to the shopping mall. When my show was on, it was a crazy to live.
I mean, and I can't imagine.
Right, because there was not an internet then.
Right.
There was not a way to, you had like 4 channels and cable wasn't even doing very much. Back in the early 90s, you know?
Yeah.
The study of fame through Deborah Vance, what it means and what it doesn't. What I loved, my favorite moment of the show so far, has been when she flagged down the bus driver and got on the double-decker bus and started doing stand-up. Because if that isn't like a soap dish moment with Whoopi and Sally Field, right?
Yeah.
Let's go to the mall and get people who love you and scream about you.
Uh-huh.
Because if you ever get used to that, if that ever becomes the norm, you're pretty much done for.
Yeah,
you're
screwed. And what a risk to then go in front of those same fans and say, well, here's a new version of me. Here's a different story. Here's a different tale.
Exactly.
Because it's putting it all on the line. And it's really, I mean, can you imagine? It's like not only about your identity, but it's also about your, you know, the thing that you know they want, you're not going to give them. How do you expect that to go? You know, and it doesn't go well for a lot of the season.
Yeah. And that's real. You know, people think that if you were a stand-up comic like me, I stopped doing stand-up in 1996 when my show started, because people in the audience were appalled that I was doing what I was doing, which was an art form rooted in rage and anger.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, not that I was Sam Kennison by any means, but, you know, I would tell off Woody Allen, and at the time was as popular as the Kardashians in terms of fame of his scandal and what he did. I always took a stand for things. But these people who only saw me on TV for the last, you know, year comes to Caesars to see me. And, oh, my God, she's not like that on the television. She just burst.
Wow. So that was, you decided, you made a choice.
I had to. I finished my contract there. I had two more appearances. And then after that, I didn't do it anymore because it was too hard to bridge the gap between mm-hmm. this persona that Daytime sort of grasped and created and was real as well to also a stand-up comic nighttime person, you know, who has been doing that since she was 16.
Well, that's the thing. So, I know you started young and because you come from stand-up, I'm curious. Now, you got to perform live on your show because you had an audience. You got to be funny live. You got to have the laughter and all of that. But did you miss stand-up? Did you miss doing
it? I did. And I missed the camaraderie. I mean, you know, once you get known for something, usually in stand-up, it's something not stand-up-y. There's not a lot of stand-up comics who kind of break the barrier without having another platform. So there's a crippling that happens when that happens because the audience will laugh no matter what you say.
Right.
When you're so big that you go into the 7-Eleven and you ask for TikToks and the person laughs.
Yeah.
And then you start going, wait a second, you know, where's your gauge for what's really funny by normal human interaction that you can no longer have? Because you're in some sort of stratosphere with Oprah Winfrey in people's minds, you know, because we were both daytime talk shows.
Right.
And listen, I've been around her. She's a meteor. She's a once a generation type amalgamation of a human that is sort of unbelievable. Right.
Well, and so are you.
Well, honey, I don't think so. I mean, it's in a completely different way. And I don't really relate to it that, you know, without disparaging anyone, because listen, getting to be in her orbit for the time that I have been so far has been pretty thrilling. You know, when I think of the people that I've been able to meet as a result of my fame, I think that's an unbelievable gift that I've been given. Right. Mm-hmm. To know these champions of, you know, social justice and entertainment and art and get to mingle in that crowd. You know, I miss the camaraderie that women didn't get to have in stand up because there were so few of us that they would never book us together. Or if they did, it would be a big thing like women's comedy night, estrogen night. Like they would write that on the, you know, board up there.
Yeah. They wrote the ha-ha in there.
Exactly. Vinny's ha-ha palace. But there is a camaraderie of going to the clubs and knowing everybody and hanging out. But, you know, once I had children, which was 26 years ago, that made it hard to leave at night, you know?
Right.
Angie has made it easier than ever to hire high-quality pros to get all your home service jobs done well. Whether it's routine maintenance, an emergency repair, or a dream project, Angie lets you compare quotes from multiple local pros, browse homeowner reviews, and even book a service instantly. Angie's been connecting people with skilled pros for nearly 30 years. So the next time you have a home project, bring it to Angie to get your job done well. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's ANGI.com.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
So I have a question about something you were saying, like in terms of that thing of when you're super famous and so you realize that anything you say will get a laugh.
Yeah.
Does that ever go away? Like, do you still feel that kind of thing right now? Or
No, because just like no one knew Joan Rivers had a late night talk show and was the first woman to break through there. Mm-hmm. Nobody really knows that I was a stand-up comic anymore. They sort of don't remember that. Some people don't know I was on a TV show.
That's crazy.
But you have to realize that's 25 years ago.
Right.
League of Their Own was 30 years ago.
Wow. Crazy.
So when I look at an audience in a comedy club, they're in their 20s usually. They're hanging out, drinking a little bit. No idea. Ladies and gentlemen, Rosie O'Donnell. You know, and it's like a blank slate. And I'm a middle-aged older woman, you know, that's on the stage that I don't come with a pre set of, oh, remember her? And my friends laugh at me. They go, you just think you're not famous anymore. I go, no, I know it feels different. I have anonymity to walk in the mall with my kid. And unless I talk, people don't know it's me.
Wow.
And
how do you feel about that generally? Do you like that? Do you prefer
it? I love it.
You do?
I prefer it, yeah. Yes. Because you can actually have anonymous encounters with like the cashier, mm-hmm. because they usually don't like, or the guy who delivers the Uber Eats. Like sometimes you'll, people will go, hey.
Yeah.
I'm like, it's me. I'm just old. they're like, oh, you look great, Rosie. Here's your package, you know? So people I would say 99% of the people who stop me are kind, but it doesn't happen in the frequency that it used to. And when you've been in the tidal wave, like, you know, just swimming in the Pacific doesn't seem like it's too bad. You
right,
know?
Right. Well, yeah. I bet that's partly right. I mean, not to, you tell me, but it feels like because you reached a stratosphere where everybody knew you, and I'm sure it was burdensome to have that many eyes on you.
Very heavy, very heavy.
And like you say, it was when it was like network TV, one of the few channels, everybody knew. It. I can understand, it makes sense to me why it would feel like a relief. But I wonder if for someone like Deborah, who never really reached your level, but always wanted to, right. to have a show, but just was famous enough to get a 3,000 seat theater filled. You know what I mean? Was just famous enough that Vegas people knew her, what it's like for her to be, especially out on the road where people don't know her or who do know her and aren't getting what they want from her, like what that does to her because she's still thirsty. She never got the tidal wave.
Right. You know, to obtain this elusive place is you know, Hollywood is an illusion. Mm. Mm-hmm. And I had the fantasy too, and it's sold like this, that there were parties that you all were invited to, and it would be Bette Midler and Liza and Barbara Streisand, and, you know, Marvin Hamlisch would be on the piano, and they'd all take turns singing, and they'd be passing out hors d'oeuvres, and everyone was just like chummy, and never happened. It happened, you know, a couple times at Liza Minnelli's house.
Yeah.
She invited me to her birthdays, and it was kind of like that at her house. But there was no kind of, you know, the Judy Garland showbiz, we're all going to be in this together, you know. And I also thought that with fame came a superpower because, you know, this is a story I've told so much that it sounds like a trope, but it's the truth, that when my mom got sick, I remember thinking if everyone who loved Johnny Carson sent in $1 million, we'd get the medicine and my mother would get well. Mm. So I always thought in fame there was power to do social good. Mm-hmm. And I thought like everybody felt that way Everyone who was famous also felt an obligation to do right for the world because you were given this unbelievable kind of gift or burden. Mm. And you had to figure out if you could keep your side of the window clean.
Right. Wow.
Right. So the light can get through.
Wow.
But the more noise, the more fame, the more, you know, and then I kept adopting kids because that's what grounded me. Mm-hmm. That's what made me realize what matters and what doesn't. And it's what let me or forced me to leave my own show because my mom died when I was in fifth grade. And here I had a first grader and I wanted to be there at his shows. I wanted to be, you know, the one who picked him up every day. I wanted to. You know, and that was a big thing from having been driven for the last 7 years everywhere. I had to go every day to pick him up. And it was a big deal that I was able to do it every day and that I had to get there a half an hour early because I couldn't parallel park. So I had to be the first one in the line. So it was me and one other very neurotic mother who was there as early as I was. And we got to be friends. And but, you know, it was my children that made me go, you know, what happened really was they told me I had $100 million or something. And I said, seriously? And they said, yes. I said, okay, I don't ever want to talk about money again. Mm. I don't want anyone to ever tell me anything because I have 5 kids and a family. And surely this is enough for us to survive. I do not have to work anymore.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
And I never understood why people didn't do that, you know?
Yeah.
Like I remember saying if I was Oprah Winfrey like 15 years ago, I would have been on an island with Stedman, you know,
yeah,
having
yeah.
pineapple every day and swimming naked with the scuba gear on.
Well, it's so fascinating because it sounds honestly like you're very well adjusted, because so many Hollywood people, comics, actor, you know, they never reach that. Deborah has it too. It's like that. It's insatiable. There's always something better that they're reaching for. And so it's kind of fascinating that didn't afflict you in that way, that it affected your life.
No, but you know, very few people do what I did at the height of their fame, offering millions and millions to stay, say yeah. no and walk away. Mm-hmm. Now, I went into my suburban house, and then we had four houses on like 1 acre,
wow.
you know, because we were in suburbia. And yeah. one of them was an art studio. And I would go in every day and paint for years. And it took me that long to sort of land back on earth, because you almost need celebrity detox.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, like you have to stop asking if the, you know, waitress can get you a special order of Dover sole with, you know, spinach only. Like that flies when you're sitting at a table with famous people, but it doesn't fly in real life, you know?
Right, yeah. right. I'm curious, when you were doing that and you stepped back, because you are a comedian and so you have that brain, and even though you were grounded and you had your kids and you were, it sounds like, much better adjusted than someone like Deborah Vance, did you still have, were you like, oh, that's a good joke? Oh, that's good. You know, like,
oh, totally.
What was your outlet for that? Did you write it down? What were you doing?
No. I would call up other comics who are my friends and say, did you see that? Or when this first came on, I called all my friends who were stand ups, the women, and said, you got to watch this fucking show. Oh,
thank you.
It's unbelievable.
Thank you.
No, because it really is. And especially if you're me. I mean, I feel like I'm looking at myself in some capacity, you know? The trajectory maybe is not the same, and the details or the style, but it's pretty tracking of, you know, I mean, you know, I was lucky because of that insatiability that you talk about. When when I was famous, it felt like a tsunami. It felt like you just try to keep your head above the water.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how did your assistant, who that woman is so fucking talented.
She is.
Meg Stalter.
How did you find her on YouTube or something?
We found her in Ohio. We completely trained her. All of her skill is from our instruction. No, yeah, we knew of her because she was like, you know, she was doing alt comedy stuff in New York and doing videos on Instagram. And so we knew of her. And then she and I were doing, we both were on the same stand-up show in LA. And Meg Stalter, in a lot of the characters that she did, she does this like bumbly, stuttery thing, which was weirdly almost like a sister to this kind of a character. It was someone who was really self-confident, really self-assured, but then would be talking incorrectly, kind of. It was like an interesting dichotomy of really self-assured and also insecure. She's just so, so funny. But also,
she really is.
The kinds of original characters she plays kind of matches this person that we're writing toward. So she seems to make a lot of sense. And then when I did this live show with her, I think I said to Jen and Lucia, I really hope it's her, because the live show is so electric and fun and funny and different and not normal stand-up. I mean, she's so improvisational and so she's just a live wire. So we auditioned a bunch of people, but of course she was perfect for it.
Oh, Jesus. Kayla, it's Saturday. You got to start using that calendar I gave you.
Oh, no, I know. I heard you had to cancel your trip to Cabo this weekend because you had to work. Mm. I thought I'd come here in case you need anything.
Oh.
Plus, I feel so bad about your trip that at lunchtime, I'm going to make you a piña colada. Bring a little island to you, brother.
Oof, okay. Not an island. Also, be careful with the accent, but that's actually very sweet. Just do me a favor. Could you make it virgin since I'm working?
I don't think I can, but I can try.
Okay. Thank you. Thanks for coming in.
My boss. Gotta love him.
It's just I love when the scenes come to you guys. I love it. I'm like, I wish they would cut away to them more often. You know, it's such a brilliant show, you guys. You should be really proud
Thank
of yourself.
You. Thank you.
The people like you, you know, feeling, especially female comedians, really, you know, saying like, I feel like this feels real, or I love Gene in it, or like this resonates with me. Like that, there cannot be, it is impossible to have a higher compliment than that. Because to us, you know, if we're doing something that is a facsimile of this kind of a person, or it feels like a caricature or anything derivative, then forget it, pack it up and go home. You know, it's like, it has to connect.
No, it's totally fresh. It's fresh. It's new. It's like, it opens you to all of your emotions. I mean, I know that it hits me right in the deep red center of the target of my heart.
I'm curious, because you did stand up and wrote material, what you felt, because I'm, and as Lucia said, it's so gratifying that especially female standups feel like it's real, since we wanted the show to be very grounded and realistic. How you felt about that thing where she finally figures it out on stage, just in a night, just happened to figure it out?
It reminded me very much of the time I went to do an AIDS benefit, or some kind of gay-themed medical benefit mm-hmm. for something. And I was doing like my old act, for lack of a better word. I was just doing my, you know, 15 minutes for this charity and getting off the stage. And I look and I see, after like 10 minutes, I'm supposed to do 15 minutes. And I look and I see Ron Jeremy, the porn star, in the front row. And I'm like, oh, what? Man. I'm like, are you Ron Jeremy, the porn star? He's like, yeah. Well, then I did like 10 minutes on Ron Jeremy, the porn star. And by the end, the people were like standing and having a great time. So I walk off stage, and the director, gay woman from England, who has all these one-person theater shows that she's revered for, she came over to me and she said, I'm going to tell you something right now. Don't ever do an old joke again, because you're only showing them how fast your brain works when you put the new material out. They know you can recite your old shit, but can you still punch?
Ooh,
you know?
That's wow. great. Like,
that's a good comment.
Yeah.
And so I knew when she was felt safe enough to try to be vulnerable and tell the truth. You know, when I got choked up when she said the thing about her sister, that it hurt me the most in my whole life, right? Mm-hmm. And the audience was with her through. It didn't have to be joke, 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 mm-hmm. joke, joke. They went on the ride with her, and she had them like in her hand. And mm-hmm. I thought when I watched it, well, she's right. That is the essence of a special right there,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
She's got the main thought, the mm-hmm. overriding thing the piece is going to be about, which is about her coming to peace with herself and her life and her truths. And that's really all we have as artists, mm-hmm. right? And the more we try to joke our way out of it or paint our, we just have to sit in it. You have to sit in it and do it. You know, I mean, I have a sister that I was very, very close to. And then money got involved. And it's been years since we've seen each other. And when my older brother had some real heart problems, we saw each other at the hospital briefly. And it's not like we're uncordial to each other. Mm-hmm. But this is like 20 years of my life that she was just removed, you know? And I remember always thinking, too, that's one thing that fame cost me, you know, my sister.
Mm. Wow.
That's hard. Because
money fucks up everything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I don't know if Deborah's rich. I don't know what her money situation is, but it seems like she is.
She is. I think that's the thing. She doesn't have that tsunami and that tidal wave of acclaim or being universally famous, but she does have money, and that's been for her a real protection. You know, that's why she built this castle for herself, and she has all these possessions. She's obsessed with possessions because they can't hurt her. You know, she can own them and collect them and stockpile them, but they can't ever betray her because she owns them. So she has a lot of money, especially from her, you know, her product line and all of that stuff. You know, her residency.
That was hysterical how you set up the pop-up shop for HSN. Outside
she's always working. Yeah. She's always hawking, God. Even when she's on the road.
Yeah.
so funny.
Ladies, why do compression socks always make you look like you're about to be wheeled onto an airplane? They scream, I'm old. You want compression socks that say, Paris, not hospice. You want...
God damn it, Weed!
You ruined another take.
It's so hot, Deb. We need to turn on the air conditioner.
Well, as soon as I get a clean take, you can.
And Deborah, you forgot the American flag print.
Ugh. Stupid fucking American flag. Okay.
Okay, let's go from Halloween.
I really was thinking what role I would want to do, you know. My first thought was someone who was canceled, who was her friend, and she didn't stand up for her. And now, like, I'm working at, like, the Rainbow Palace, you know, like, off the strip.
Yeah,
and
I'm
the MC host, and I drink my way through it. And, you know, it's like a horrible thing. Yeah. But every month, I ask to go out to dinner with her, and she finally accepts because she feels bad for me. And, you know, I'm just canceled.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Excellent pitch.
Excellent. My other idea is that I am the blackjack dealer's adoptive mother. And I play poker in all the championships, and I'm a real gambler. And she has to watch her way with me because I'm always there trying to get money from her and, you know, kind of like a sloppy drunk at the table.
I like that.
You as a competitive poker player is really funny.
It is really funny.
That's hilarious.
That could be so funny, right?
Oh,
and then
God.
I get drunk one night, and she brings me up to Deborah's room, and Deborah and I end up having a deep talk about something, you know.
She tries to set you straight, and then you've...
Okay, we love it.
Yeah, I love them all.
I also am really connecting to the mother-daughter-ish themes that are in there, I think, because, you know, that's a story that is always the one I tell. Oh, the worst thing that happened to me, right? You lose your mother at 10. But you're always looking then for mothers and at mother-daughter relationships. And you try to think, what would yours be like? And you wish that it would be like, you know, the Bravermans, you know, on parenthood. But the reality is most of the adult women I'm friends with who are my age, they have contentious relationships with their moms and they're, you know, trying to figure it out. And so to have a show where both sets of lead women have trouble with their moms, I think was a brilliant way to do it. And then to see them at the end, like both their heads together drinking a, you know, a drink or whatever, to see them both kind of being intimate with each other in maternal ways, you know.
Yeah, we wanted to explore this idea of also, you know, Ava struggling to connect with her mom and them dealing with the tragedy of her dad passing away suddenly, but also the intersection of when, you know, your parent or family member kind of is trying to understand what you do comedy-wise and entertainment, because that can be kind of a weird thing for someone who's outside of it to grasp. I'm curious, Rosie, like, what was your experience with your family watching your stand-up or being involved in it, or how did they react to what you were doing?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. My dad was not really a, I'll come to see your show tonight at the club, honey. I think maybe he came to the show once. I don't really remember that much. But, you know, it was more like everyone in my world. The first night I did stand up, it was because this boy in my grade, his 10-year older brother, owned a nightclub in our town. And he asked if I wanted to come to the comedy club and perform. And I said no, because I don't want to be a stand-up comic. I want to be on Broadway. And he was like, what? And I said, yeah, I don't really have any interest in stand-up comedy. He's like, just come and try it. So I invited everyone from my high school, and I made fun of everyone in the high school. Like, Marilyn's going out with Mitchell, and Greg doesn't know. And everybody would laugh, who are my friends, and make a funny joke about the teacher. And I killed. And then the next night he'd asked me to come back, and it was a school night and nobody could come. So I went by myself and I died a horrible death, like not just a small death. I died like as good as I did the first night, as silent it was the second night. And so I came off the stage and the owner said, why don't you come be the MC on the nights, not on the weekend? It'll teach you and you'll get to watch. And I was 16 years old, you know.
Wow.
So it made a huge difference. I would go to the club every night and watch all these comedians, you know, try to be funny, and my only job was to say thank you and coming up next. But eventually you start to work the crowd a little bit, and you know, and here I was, a kid who looked like the people in the audience's children.
Yeah,
you know what
amazing.
I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
I looked like one of them could be my mom or dad.
I have a question for you. Like, you know, there's, you know, the episode, obviously, kind of this big moment is when Deborah has this one night stand with Devon Sawa, who played the role so wonderfully, and we were so lucky to have him. And they have this intimate bedroom scene.
How'd you get the scar?
Oh, when I was a kid, this bully in our neighborhood was chasing my little sister on his bike. So I tackled him.
Tackled him? Well, that's sweet. You guys close?
We were. Then she ran off with my husband.
Jesus Christ, are you kidding?
Mm-mm.
That's fucking crazy. How could they do that to you?
Truth be told, it wasn't entirely their fault. I think they both felt neglected because I cared more about my career than I did about them.
Ah.
Let's not talk about that.
One of the things I love about this scene that I can take no credit for, but I can give credit to Paul W. Downs, who directed it, is I remember we were talking about the way that it was going to be shot and how Paul was going to shoot it with our DP, Adam Bricker. And I remember Paul saying, I don't want to put them up against, like, kind of sitting in bed with their backs against the headboard, because, you know, that is something you kind of traditionally see a lot in a post-coital scene. But it's difficult. It's not as, like, you're not as connected. You're kind of not looking at each other. And so, Paul, one of the things I love about this scene is the way it's blocked with Jean and Devon on the bed kind of facing each other. And it makes it, to me, a much more intimate moment that I really love. But I'm curious, Rosie, what was your experience as a fan kind of seeing Deborah Vance getting to have this fun one-night stand moment with this younger man that she meets on the road?
Yeah, I think that Jean with the having sex with the guy was great. First of all, she's gorgeous. She's sexual.
Yeah.
She's sensual. And I know a lot of women, which I'll tell you when we're off this, what's been happening to me, who after 60, like, have a recharge or a rebirth or something of their sexuality. And I've had a lot of friends tell me about it. And then, you know, experiencing a little bit of it myself and feeling like, you know, there's a time when you're in the middle of menopause. And my menopause started at 40, where you think, I will never have sex again. And the person who asks me to, I will hurt them. You know, it's like, it feels as though it's an unimaginable thing. And then, like, the hormones kind of level out and you're like, oh, look, this still works. Oh, I'm going to see what happens with this, you know?
Hmm.
Oh, the funniest thing cracked me up when they were playing Celebrity.
Oh. Ready?
Mm-hmm.
Go.
Bought your old house.
Suzanne Plachet.
Yes. Saw your hairdresser.
Keith Urban.
Yes. Didn't say hi, JFK.
Marie Osmond.
Yeah. Oh, cheap couch.
Oh, Barbara Bush, this is so easy.
You used to share a gardener.
Siegfried. Roy.
Yes. Innocent.
Ted Kennedy.
Yes.
There was no guardrail.
5 seconds.
Broken. Condom.
Robert Mitchum.
Yes!
Time!
We did it!
The names that you chose. Marie Osmond. Suzanne Plachet. She bought your old house. And that was hysterical.
But we just felt like we'd seen Celebrity on TV, but Celebrity with celebrities is hilarious because they get to play by different rules.
Totally. It's so unfair. You guys are fantastic, and your show is the goddamn bomb.
Ah, thank you.
Truly, I am so happy to have met you, Rosie. Really, really, really.
Thank you, Paul. Right. I feel like I know you guys.
Well, I'm sure a lot of people say that to you, but we do feel like we know you. Let's have a game night. Let's hang out. I want to be your friend. I would like to be your friend.
Yes, let's be friends.
Not to be weird.
100%.
Okay, let's do
not
that thing that you talked about, you know, hors d'oeuvres, hanging out, like laughing, Judy Garland party. But let's just do it with us, you know?
I'll start learning piano now.
Okay, I'll buy one. I'll buy
okay.
one.
Okay, great.
We will see you soon at game night.
I would love that.
See you at game night.
Okay, holding you to it.
All right. Bye.
Love you, Rosie.
Bye.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is the Hacks official podcast. with Lucia Aniello, Paul W. Downs, and Jen Statsky. This podcast is a production of HBO Max and Pineapple Street Studios. Our executive producers are Barry Finkel, Gabrielle Lewis, Jenna Weiss-Berman, and Max Linsky. Our producers are Biandria July, Melissa Slaughter, and Ari Saperstein. Our managing producer is Aaron Kelly, and Maria Robin Somerville is our associate producer. Darby Maloney is our editor. The show is mixed by Twee McCallum, with engineering from Davey Sumner. Production music is courtesy of HBO. You can watch episodes of Hacks on HBO Max. Until next time.